Lawrence Durrell occupies a strained position in Commonwealth literature. I think that could be an understatement. A British author, he was born and raised in India by parents who had not been to Britain. After going home, I put that in quotation marks, for his education at 11, he left Britain in 1935, aged 23, and never made it his long-term residence again. Yet, he worked for the British Foreign Office for most of his professional career in contentious places and periods. Alexandria in World War II, Rhodes during the ceding of the Dodecanese to the Greece, Belgrade under Tito, Argentina in Perón's first term, and Cyprus during Enosis. So not easy postings, typically. He also wrote in and of these locations. He settled permanently in France and published Bitter Lemons in Alexandria the Alexandria Quartet in 1957, in the direct wake of the Suez Crisis, alluding to it in both works. How then do we discuss the theoretically and politically charged issues of silence, speaking, and irony? I'm not going to overtly theorize those terms. I think you know where I'm going just by using them, so I'll leave that as potentially something we can use in the discussion. What does he offer Commonwealth literary studies in general? My paper outlines the critical conflicts, discusses biographical approaches to Durrell's position in these conflicts, and ends with a close reading of some of the selected texts. So, ranging from a force for reconciliation and beyond an instrument for aesthetic pleasure of the privileged, literature also has the sinister capacity for propaganda, division, exclusionary elitism, and hate. Readings of Durrell rightly cover this entire range. In 1962, Mahmoud Mantalawi, who's actually from here at UBC, declared the Alexandria Quartet exhibited, quote, an essential falsity of description, and he compared Durrell to Mediterranean fortune seekers who exploited, carved out their fortunes, and distorted facts to justify their position. In contrast, 40 years later, M.G. Vasanji, in 2002, located Durrell as a positive cosmopolitan influence, and Carol Phillips notes Durrell's expatriate status greatly influenced his work, and he openly acknowledges a love-hate relationship with Britain. This conflict between Durrell as a critic of empire and an exponent for colonialism is not resolved and continues to drive critical debates. However, I do not suggest all forms of colonialism and imperialism are the same, despite geographical, social, ethnic, and temporal differences. Durrell's time in India and his separation from it seem to have been highly personal. Likewise, his time on Rhodes during the ceding of the Dodecanese to Greece appears to have been exceptionally joyful and happily completed. Egypt and Cyprus are much, much different. So I proceed with the proviso that I am generalizing about trends in writing and colonial spaces, but with the awareness that what this means to different places and times is distinct. Edward Said probably laid the groundwork for viewing Durrell as the voice of imperial power. He only mentions Durrell twice in his entire works, though. Quote, "The degree to which the cultural realm and its expertise are institutionally divorced from their real connections with power was wonderfully illustrated. I was naively trying to understand the kind of person who could order B-52 strikes over a distant Asian country. You know, my friend said, the secretary, the defense secretary of the United States, is a complex human being. He doesn't fit the picture you may have formed of the cold-blooded imperialist murderer. The last time I was in his office, I noticed Durrell's Alexandria Quartet on his desk." He paused meaningfully, as if to let Durrell's presence on that desk work its awful power alone. What the anecdote illustrates is the approved separation of high-level bureaucrat from the reader of novels of questionable worth and definite status, end quote from Said. To this anecdote, see Said as the damning endnote. The Nazi who read Rilke and then wrote out genocidal orders had not yet become known. Perhaps the Durrell Secretary of Defense anecdote might not have seemed so useful to my enthusiastic friend. Oddly, rather than separating the bureaucrat from the reader of novels, Said's friend suggests the two overlap. The official is not distinct from the novel reader, and the ills of one bleed into the other, along with influence. Oddly, Said's suggestion that aesthetic pleasure and political actions remain distinct runs contrary to virtually his entire body of work. And his Durrell anecdote demonstrates that he did, in fact, mean for the Secretary of Defense's reading habits to reflect on or even produce his military actions. His literary tastes tarnish their object. Marucci clarifies Said's intentions, recounting Said's only recorded sustained comments on Durrell given during the year he spent in Beirut learning Arabic. Quote, "One evening at the Beirut College for Women, Said addressed a large assembly on a prized work of the Orientalist canon, Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. Many of the Westerners imagined themselves Dorellian heroes in a latter-day Alexandria of intrigue and romance. I can say that's not my experience reading the quartet. Said attacked the novel's triviality, its incomprehensible metaphors, its meaningless plot. One university lecturer protested that Durrell's images were compelling. Compelling, Said asked. When he needs an image for human communication, he reaches for the telephone. I actually can't find that reference in the quartet, I might add. This typifies post-colonial readings of Durrell. The incomprehensible metaphors are dismissed precisely because they are too comprehensible, and the meaningless plot is unrecognized as a comment on Durrell's in-laws, the Menashe family, close friends to Weizmann, the first president of Israel. There is actually a strong political background to the plot, a very real background outlined by Michael Hogg last summer. It's been lying unrecognized in the biography for years. It's also tempting to note that metaphor in modern Greek likely refers to a courier, which would be an apt image for human communication. The political purpose for Said's critique is laudable, yet Durrell readers are hard-pressed to view his Western characters as heroes, or at least I am. The Westerners imagine themselves as Durrell's characters, pederasts, homosexuals, poverty-stricken and sexually humiliated tutors, incestuous authors, or inept bureaucrats, seems unlikely in 1972. Such heroes seem satiric and ironic. The only reader I know to have voiced a feeling of wonder for the heavily Orientalist Alexandria refers instead to the horrible film version of Durrell's quartet, Cukor's 1969 Justine, which received, I think calling them terrible reviews would be an understatement. This reader is M.G. Vasanji, not a Westerner in Said's audience. The enviable heroes of Cukor's Justine make it seem Said's most likely source, so do the dates. Even more difficult is Durrell's Philhellenism, which casts Alexandria through the rose-colored glass of a Homeric rosy-fingered dawn. The city is Greek in origin, but this is contrary to Arab forms of Egyptian nationalism. Greek descriptions of Alexandria's history or its Greek minority are often read and labeled Orientalist and Imperial, which ignores the culturally diverse nature of the city prior to the 1960s and continuing now. Said perpetuates this presentation of Philhellenism as anti-Arab, and hence disregards the long Greek history in Egypt. There is obviously political reasons for doing this, and viable political reasons. Yet, oddly, he uses Hellenic studies as a way of excusing scholars from his critique in Orientalism. Hellenism receives scarce comment in Orientalism and appears primarily as a title of rescue. To be a Hellenist is acceptable, despite the direct parallels in representation and infantilization of the modern over the idealized ancients. Post-colonial Greece is excluded from Said's post-colonial system. This is something I find very odd in that specific book. In conflict with this reading, Durrell was refused British citizenship, that's a quotation, in 1966, in an attempt to reduce immigration to Britain from India, Pakistan, and the West Indies. That came to light just a few years ago and is commented on by Ezard. More accurately, this isn't quite right, Durrell was denied free right of access to Britain under new laws and had to apply for a visa for each entry. This placed him in the difficult position of a non-patrial without the right to enter or settle, a fact he never made public. While race, and perhaps ethnicity, did not contribute to Durrell's exile, he served the British Foreign Office, yet was alienated from the center of empire because of his origins in India. His 1935 first novel, Pied Piper of Lovers, this has also been out of print for 72 years now, so it's not readily accessible to scholars, recounts his childhood in India and his teenage return home to London. However, he recasts his protagonist as part of the colonized indigenous population. The protagonist, Walsh Clifton, is Anglo-Indian with an Indian Burmese mother, and his Indian childhood dominates the novel. It is even written on his mother's coffin, made up of old crates, and this is an odd quotation in the novel, with great care, the Kulu apple, the white man's delight. I don't think I'd want that on my mother's coffin. This racial distinction marks Durrell's intentions in a book that is so autobiographical that scholars often fail to distinguish between Walsh as a character and Durrell himself as the author. Race then marks Durrell's ambiguity with regard to his ancestral home, and he is adamant in interviews that his banishment from India by his father was a childhood trauma, marking his loss of mother India for father England. He repeats this trend in his ongoing, biologically unlikely assertion of his Irishness. This tension between mother India and father Britain is clear in the first image of England in Pied Piper of Lovers. Carol Phillips describes in an uncanny parallel his vision of such a moment at sea. In Phillips' A Dream Deferred in Kunapipi, he writes of the immigration policies that restricted non-patrial citizens of the empire, constitutionally British, from entering or settling in Britain from the West Indies. It's the same set of legislation. Quote, I have imagined the scene many times. Crowds of West Indians are peering from the deck of a ship, eagerly securing their first view of the white cliffs of Dover. At the moment of that first sighting, I imagine their dominant emotion would have been that of a profound sense of loss, for clearly they knew that it would be many years before they would return home to loved ones and familiar landscapes. End quote. The poignancy for Phillips is that these crowds of West Indians are British non-patriots under increasing limitations in the Commonwealth to enter or settle in Britain. To expand his scope or offer an illusion, Phillips need only have skimmed further back in Durrell's Tide Piper of Lovers, which he anthologized for Faber and Faber in his collection Elegant Strangers, only 1 year prior to delivering that scene, which he recounts in A Dream Deferred, as the Arthur Ravencroft Memorial Lecturer at the University of Leeds. In it, his West Indians experience the same odd grip of nostalgia approaching Britain, nostalgia as a pain for an unfamiliar and foreign home. Durrell's vision in his autobiographical novel is equally poignant as Phillips in a remarkably similar way. Quote, it would have been impossible to define accurately the feeling of disappointment Walsh experienced as he stood on the deck of the liner and watched the pearly cliffs insinuate themselves out of the light sea haze. It was smaller than he had imagined. This observation implied some sort of intuitive deduction. Those who shouted, pointed, and exclaimed were in the minority. A great number stood silent, gripping the rail and experiencing that emotion of country love which is occasioned in exiles. Walsh's distance from Father Britain's white-as-white cliffs, cliffs that recall his less-than-white skin, is compounded by difference from Mother India. He turns to a, quote, small and gentle-looking Aya, whose hands folded inside her sari, and feels sick with an undefined regret as though the beauty of the hills which he had left forever still worked in him. As Bowker points out in his biography, the young colonial was returning home, but also setting off into exile. Walsh asks this young Aya, you are of the hills, to which she responds, yes, of Nepal. When he asserts his own home in the same manner, the only home he's ever known, he says shyly, I too am from the hills, Kursiong. She becomes silent. She seemed to regard him as yet another of the alien race with whom she had nothing in common, save the coincidence of a common dwelling, a birthplace and a country for her, for him no more than a temporary house. I should point out that's 1935 that that was published. He is homeless, estranged from both houses, in both cases for reasons of ethnicity. Unexpectedly, Durrell draws on the same tropes of alienation, displacement, and non-patrial exclusion described by Phillips and common to so many Commonwealth writers. The impulse for a broad reader is then to question Durrell's colonial privilege, which M.G. Basenji describes in his lecture on Durrell as being seen from across the street. He can only see Durrell from across the street. He's on the wrong side, Durrell's on the right side. The colonizer on one side, the colonized on the other. Despite the binary opposition, Durrell appears to have been in the crowd rather than watching from one side or the other, and the crowd is usually the majority. A second poignant instance of difference appears in the Alexandria Quartet when, for Mount Olive, a diplomat trained to regard the Orient through the apparatus of his books and formal Arabic, the Orient explicitly comes alive via his unconscious desires. This is very explicit in the text. Egypt is, quote, seen from the vantage point of someone inside the canvas of his own imagination, which his own imagination had painted. And here Mount Olive had suddenly found the exotic becoming completely normal. Its poetry was irradiated by the unconscious with which it was lived. Mount Olive's Orientalist construct of Egypt and of his lover Laila Hosnani becomes overt. His brutal, sensual, thrilling Orient is immediately juxtaposed to Laila's view of the West, her construction of a sexualized and conquering other. When asked why she loves him, Laila quotes her favorite author, whom Anne Zolin recognizes as Ruskin in Imperial Duty. Quote, why do you love me? There is a destiny now possible to us, the highest ever set before a nation to be accepted or refused. We are still undegenerate in race, a race mingled of the best northern blood. I don't think of whispering this into my wife's ear at night. Mount Olive listened to her voice with astonishment, pity, and shame. It was clear that what she saw in him was something like a prototype of a nation which existed now only in her imagination. Direct repetition of the word on the same page. She was kissing and cherishing a painted image of England. It was the oddest experience in the world. Only in this invasion of his own identity does Mount Olive confront the nature of projection, which dominates the quartet. In his paroxysm over Lila's misprision, David finally speaks. "Stop, stop," he cried sharply. "We are not like that any longer, Lila." It was an absurd book-fed dream this Copt had discovered and translated, and that word gets played with quite a bit as opposed to transplantation. He felt as if all those magical embraces had been somehow won under false pretenses, as if her absurd thoughts were reducing the whole thing, diminishing the scale of it to something as shadowy and unreal as, say, a transaction with a woman of the streets. Can you fall in love with the stone effigy of a dead crusader? I think that's ironic given the fact that he has fallen in love with something his own imagination has irradiated onto Egypt. Through Lila's occidentalism, Mount Olive becomes the psychological construction of others, becomes aware of this. Nonetheless, he does not recognize, quote, the canvas his own imagination had painted, irradiated by the unconscious. She fell in love with him because he is English, he because she is Egyptian. The East is the receptive canvas for his projections of the West, and vice versa. Similarly, Derek Gregory, also from UBC, his work on representations of Egypt in the 19th century seems highly akin on this issue of dural criticism. It may be cliched to point out that, quote, the Orient was constructed as a theatrical stage on which the Occident projected its own fantasies and desires. We pretty much accept that readily now. Especially in dural studies, since Manzelawi's 1962 article, The Curate's Egg, makes this point emphatically. And notably precedes Said by 16 years. Yet this argument deserves expansion. Gregory explores the relationship between human geography and Orientalist imagery by using Nile travel narratives, and Durrell uses the trope of such a narrative in his later novel series, The Avignon Quintet. For Gregory, he uses Florence Nightingale. Her frustration with the Nile turns out not so much on the inadequacy of her descriptions as on the inadequacy of their object, the Egyptian landscape. It was to her a world turned upside down, an inversion of the ordered and Christian world of Europe. Significantly, Gregory describes Egypt as an antithesis to Europe. In Durrell's work, this dialectical opposition is overtly degraded on a number of instances. In the Avignon Quintet, the journey through the same landscape inverts Europe and shows Egypt reflecting elements of Europe back to the European gaze. Basically, their own projection is sent back to them. Moreover, the journey down the Nile is exactingly repeated, except that the repetition is down the Rhone to Avignon. Not only do the Nile and the Rhone merge, and this is a textual repetition, it's meant to be obvious to the readers, but the place names become confused, with the scenes in Avignon occurring in a chapter entitled Outremer, literally overseas, the name for the Middle East during the Crusades, while the scenes in Egypt occur in Macabre, which is derived from the French troubadour poet Macabrun. So we have French names for Egyptian locations, and France becomes a foreign site that's no longer Europe. Very odd. The sands of Egypt mirror the snows of southern France. This is a direct textual thing that happens. Egypt is named for a French troubadour, and the knowledge gained in it subverts Christian orthodoxy, hence turning the palace of the popes in Avignon into an exotic Outremer. Gregory draws out these similar themes in 19th century literature, critically, but Durrell seems to have anticipated this critical move and actively subverts the literary traditions that critics like Gregory are examining. Yet none of this is spoken overtly. It exists in the silences, juxtapositions between the two. Another politicized allusion speaks silently for indigenous voices. In Bitter Lemons, published in 1957, immediately after the Suez Crisis, Durrell's first sentence is, "This is not a political book." I think John's going to point out to us in the second session that that is not the case. However, the 1887 epigram from Hepworth Dixon states, quote, "A race advancing on the east must start with Cyprus. The opening of the Suez Canal has suddenly restored her to her place of ancient place of pride." I wouldn't start a non-political book with that kind of a comment directly after the Suez Crisis. The second epigram contrasts, quote, "But the poor Cypriots are a much enduring people, and God, in his mercy, avenges them." And that vengeance happens quite a bit in the book, which recounts Enosis and various political acts and terrorist acts on Cyprus. These comments contradict each other and presage Durrell's paternalistic narrative of his life on and flight from Cyprus during political conflicts. Again, in the irony of his non-political book and the Suez Canal, which was nationalized by Nasser only 1 year prior to Bitter Lemons, the silence of a nationalist voice for Cyprus is pressing. It doesn't get spoken in the book. Durrell does not speak for this voice, but he makes its absence profoundly felt and ironically contagious to the rest of the book. What, then, of speaking and silence? Durrell's confused position makes such discussion difficult. Yet we have a trend in his renamed locales, his decisions to allude heavily to political histories of colonialism, and his trope of miscommunication between individuals who stand for cultural groups. The colonized are given voice through allusion, through landscape, and through a variety of indirect means. They are not ventriloquized. Or, when they are, the effect is to make the obvious the problems in doing so. The caricatures simply do not function, which to me would seem to indicate some form of irony. They are ridiculously caricatured, disturbingly performed. Perhaps most ironically, this happens in his short story, Oil for the Saint, in which Greek peasants whom Durrell knew well on a personal level for many years are given pidgin English in all of their dialogue, even though Durrell is at great pains in the story to repeatedly emphasize that his conversations are entirely in Greek. The story also has a lot of allusions to Thomas Hardy, Return of the Native, in which there's Eustacia Vye, who's a Corpiet bandmaster's daughter, and this shifting landscape in colonial territory becomes a big submerged part of the text, but never directly commented on. The effect is an ironic trap for the reader who too easily accepts these stereotypes. The effect is silence, functioning as a cynosure, in the full sense of the word, something that both attracts attention and guides it. How do the colonizer and colonized in Durrell's work speak? I suggest neither does, since neither side is listening to the other, and this is certainly not a trend limited to Durrell's works alone. Only in the silence, in irony, and illusion, is there a voice for communication. And alas, critics have not had much of an ear for Durrell's elusiveness or irony. It is far too convenient to regard Le Grand Suppositoire as sincere. Thank you very much.